It's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversation, controversy, and maybe change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio, in the iTunes store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today in our Des Moines studio, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Drake University, and Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science also at Drake. Rachel, Dennis, always good to have you in as a duo.
It's good to be here.
It's good to be anywhere at my age.
Oh, we have plenty to cover. You at your age, Dennis, you're in shape to get through this, I am sure. Even though it's quite a list of politics we have today. Later in the hour, does Nancy Pelosi have enough support to be Speaker of the House when it reconvenes with a Democratic majority in January? And what will be the Democrats' priorities when they control the House? Kim Reynolds, did you hear that comment? She called out 4th District Congressman and fellow Republican Steve King after these controversies over his views on race and his associations with figures tied to white nationalism. We'll get Dennis and Rachel's views on that a bit later in the hour. But first half hour, mostly about the fact that last week Donald Trump tapped Iowan. He was born in Des Moines, Matthew Whitaker, to serve as acting attorney general after Jeff Sessions resigned at the president's request. In other words, was fired a day after the election. Whitaker's elevation has raised some concerns about his qualifications, his past statements as a U.S. Senate candidate, his business practices. We'll hear some of that a bit later. Whitaker has repeatedly criticized the Russia investigation. He'll now oversee it. Democrats calling for Whitaker to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation. Yesterday, we heard in our news at the top of the hour, Maryland's top lawyer asking a federal judge to block Whitaker from serving as acting U.S. Attorney General, contending that that appointment is illegal. They think he should be replaced by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who was confirmed by the Senate. And the latest, very latest on this, within the last hour or two, acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker's temporary appointment was legal, says the Justice Department. That's in a memo today, Dennis and Rachel. But this memo evidently did not address whether he must recuse himself from the Russia investigation. A lot to take in there. What should we pay attention to, Dennis?
Well, I think we can't know at this point precisely what Mr. Whitaker might do. You know, he functioned as a partisan, certainly, when he ran for the Republican nomination for Senate several years ago. I think it's the one that Joni Ernst eventually won. Mm-hmm. He was a commentator on CNN and certainly articulated a more conservative, if not Trumpian, kind of view. And as we know, that seems to be the president's chief recruiting tool for positions in his administration. People he sees on TV, certainly people he sees on Fox. Matt Whitaker, I believe, was on CNN various times. So it must have been an off moment when the president was watching the network he hates. But, you know, it looks pretty clear that Matt Whitaker has a certain loyalty to and support of the president. And perhaps dating to his business days as head of his own company or companies, the president takes loyalty to him personally as the supreme value for anybody he puts in various positions. And unless we see evidence to the contrary, the appearance is that's why he appointed Matt Whitaker.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it the same way, Rachel?
Well, I do. I think one of the things that we should keep an eye on here, we're kind of on dueling timelines. So we know, or it certainly seems, that Robert Mueller is getting closer to issuing a report, which, of course, would render this controversy moot since we would have the report and the investigation will have wrapped up. At the same time, Matthew Whitaker has suggested that he will solicit an opinion from the Justice Department just to him to evaluate whether or not he should recuse himself in the Russia investigation. He has not necessarily committed to following their recommendations, only that he would solicit their recommendations from the Department of or from the Office of Ethics within the Justice Department. So we're kind of, you know, on two tracks here. One is kind of watching what Robert Mueller's doing. The other is watching what Matt Whitaker will do regarding that investigation. And then, of course, with a new Democratic Congress coming in or Democratic House coming in January, it's all likely to come to a head in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation with Rachel Caulfield, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday, talking about the Whitaker controversy right now. 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts, your questions about this, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's deal with one of the aspects that Matt Whitaker talked about as a pundit, so to speak. In October, in conversation with CNN, Whitaker mused about the idea of just cutting the budget for the Mueller investigation.
And really, I think what ultimately the president's going to start doing is putting pressure on Rod Rosenstein, who is in charge of this investigation and is acting attorney general, and really try to get Rod to maybe even cut the budget of Bob Mueller and do something a little more stagecrafty than the blunt instrument of firing the attorney general and trying to replace him.
Cut the budget was that little glitch that was covered up by. Now, Iowa's senior U.S. Senator Charles Grassley defended the attorney general, acting attorney general Matt Whitaker. He say he doesn't understand where this concern is coming from about Whitaker defunding Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia interference in the 2016 election.
I don't know what the concern is from this standpoint. The president has said that he's not going to relieve Mueller of his responsibilities he has as special counsel.
And Grassley followed up by saying he thinks it's wrong if someone were to interfere in such a way.
And I think that it would be very wrong for the president or Matt Whitaker or anybody else to interfere with the special counsel's job.
Okay, so Senator Grassley, Dennis, trusts that the president will not mess with the Mueller investigation, trusts in the president's words.
Well, the question is, to speak metaphorically, whether you want to do as the Democrats want, which is to lock the barn door before the horse gets out, whereas Senator Grassley seems to be saying, well, it doesn't matter if the barn door is open because the horse isn't going to try to get out. But then the question is, what happens if the horse does get out? It's too late to lock the door.
I love Dennis's analogies.
We are a farm state.
Well, right. There you go. But Senator Grassley is very trusting in that regard. So all Senator Grassley would leave us is the question, well, now what do we do if, in fact, Mr. Whitaker does something to derail the investigation? Democrats want to preempt that, if at all possible.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible, let's think one scenario here, that Whitaker somehow closes the Mueller investigation, ends it somehow. Is it possible, Rachel, that Congress, that we may never see the Mueller report?
Well, I think it's vaguely possible. I think it's highly unlikely that that would happen. Democrats certainly, I don't think they would let that happen. And there's some indication that those who are working on the investigation itself believe that their work is really important. Mm-hmm. They've already gotten a number of indictments, so there will be court records with evidence presented by the Justice Department and the team of people who has pursued this investigation. So at least parts of all of this work will be in the public domain. Whether or not it's seen in a full report is, I think very, very likely, but not necessarily a given.
Mm-hmm. Another curious aspect of this, on November 9th, a few days ago, the president praised Matt Whitaker, the new acting attorney general, but he also said he doesn't know Matt Whitaker.
Well, Matt Whitaker, I don't know Matt Whitaker. Matt Whitaker worked for Jeff Sessions. And he was always extremely highly thought of, and he still is. But I didn't know Matt Whitaker. He worked for Attorney General Sessions. He was very, very highly thought of and still is highly thought of. But this only comes up because anybody that works for me, they do a number on them. But Matt Whitaker is a very smart man. He is a very respected man in the law enforcement community, very respected.
Now, in fact, reporting, I've seen this too, Dennis and Rachel, the president has met with this handpicked appointee more than a dozen times, the one he says he doesn't know. As Sessions' chief of staff, Whitaker is said to have accompanied his boss to the Oval Office on multiple occasions. So what do you think of this the statement by the president that he doesn't know Whitaker and knows his background through Sessions only?
Well, we've seen this before. When President Trump really wants to indicate that he believes that whatever he's doing is correct, or he feels comfortable with the people around him, he'll make a big statement about, you know, I know this person, I trust this person. But as soon as that becomes inconvenient, one of his mechanisms for defense is to say, look, I don't really know this person. We saw it most notably, of course, with Paul Manafort. We know that Paul Manafort and the president were working closely together. Paul Manafort ran his campaign. And then, of course, when Paul Manafort was, pretty clearly going to face an indictment, all of a sudden the president said, look, I don't really know Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort was there for 2 seconds.
With Michael Cohen, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's a way of distancing himself from these controversies.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Matthew Whitaker, born in Des Moines, just looking at some of his bio information, went to Ankeny High School, former college football player at the University of Iowa. In fact, played for the Hawkeyes 1991 Rose Bowl team, ran for office of the state treasurer, lost that, later appointed by George W. Bush as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa in 2013, ran in the Republican primary. You mentioned this, Dennis, for the U.S. Senate. That was a primary won by Joni Ernst. One other aspect to comment on here. After Whitaker took office, reports now surfacing of his prior involvement with a company called World Patent Marketing, which had been fined $26 million and shut down by federal regulators in 2017 for deceiving customers. Now, World Patent Marketing was a fraudulent invention promotion firm based in Florida that deceived inventors into thinking that the company had successfully commercialized other inventions, according to reporting. Members of the advisory board included Matt Whitaker. Now, in World Patent Marketing videos from 2015, Matthew Whitaker promoted products himself for the company. This is a company that the Federal Trade Commission labeled a fraud.
Because it's a unique design that's going to help lots of people that have mobility issues get in and use their hot tub in a safe manner.
Okay, they're talking for World Patent Marketing about hot tubs, obviously. Any comment on that part of his background?
Well, I would say that the difficulty in so many of these cases is that a lot of these folks, certainly around the president, have engaged in activities that have been below the radar. They haven't been paid attention to that might be questionable, if not something more serious. But because they've been operating below the radar, think of Paul Manafort, for example, nobody's paid them any attention and hasn't gotten them into any trouble. I don't know if Matt Whitaker realized that he'd come under the microscope when he took this position, but he is now. And some of the things that have been alleged, at least in various sources, have been an implicit threat to sue somebody who questioned some aspect of a product that he was representing, or suggesting that I'm a former U.S. attorney and I wouldn't back something that I thought was shady or illegal. But whatever he might have done or not done in terms of these various allegations, and that's all they are at this particular moment, they're certainly under the microscope. And among investigative reporters, the feeding frenzy has begun.
Mm-hmm. I guess back to that question of whether he should recuse himself from the Russia investigation. What are kind of the constitutional grounds? Now, the president passed over the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein. Is it clear that he can do this constitutionally?
He has the power to appoint individuals to fill vacancies. And that power under statute, I believe they can serve in that office for 210 days. And at that point, Senate confirmation becomes necessary, either for the individual who's serving, so they formally take that appointment through Senate confirmation, or another person needs to be confirmed by the Senate. So this acting position is, by definition, temporary. Whether or not the president will put forward Matt Whitaker's name for confirmation then becomes the next step.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any final comments on Matt Whitaker and his likely fate in the next few days? Mm-hmm. He will stay in the position, you're both thinking.
At least for the time being, unless something comes out. But and he may decide that he's more concerned with the constitutional and political proprieties here. But on the other hand, there's probably a good reason why the White House put him in that position.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll see the next chapter in the coming days. And the chapters can come very quickly in our—
And a lot can happen in 210 days these times.
Only in a week.
Exactly. Things move fast.
Right. Let's talk a little bit, Dennis and Rachel, about the midterm aftermath. Now, we're hearing in our news contests for a few Senate seats and governorships really, really close. Florida, we have a recount of this Senate race. Also in Georgia, we have a judge ordering a delay in the certification of the state's results, citing concerns about voter registration, handling of provisional ballots. In Arizona, some clarity. Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat, former social worker, declared winner of a close Senate race in the state. Rachel, what are you watching as these final races get decided?
Well, I think everybody's got their eye on, certainly on Florida right now. There's a bit of a flashback to 2000 for those of us who were paying attention to that. It's gotten nasty, and it will continue to get nasty. And so, you know, I think the degree to which some of those claims are changing people's perceptions of the electoral process is really important, and potentially undermining confidence in the electoral process moving into our next election cycle. But, you know, I'm really kind of keeping an eye on the degree to which some of these states that have traditionally been very conservative, reliably Republican states are beginning to show signs that a certain kind of Democrat can really break through that red wall across the South and the Sun Belt. Mm. And what that might mean for the math in the 2020 presidential election, but what it means for a more general perception of how the parties are coming together at this point in time and whether or not we're in a period when we see the parties really shift their composition.
Mm-hmm. A certain type of Democrat. Is there a silhouette? Can you describe that that profile, Rachel, that you see possibly emerging for the Democrats?
Well, I think Kyrsten Sinema is a really interesting example. She is not a firebrand Democrat. She ran as a moderate Democrat and did very well. One of the things that a lot of people have noted is that there are kind of two competing narratives for this midterm cycle. The first is that, you know, this was fundamentally a nationalized election. And so everywhere all across the country, we were talking about national issues. It was a referendum on the president. And then there's this counter narrative, which is basically when you have the right candidates for the right places, they tend to do well. And one, you know, one explanation for some of these races is that the Democrats did a really good job of selecting candidates that match the constituency. And certainly, you know, across the South and the Sun Belt, Kyrsten Sinema is an interesting example. But the fact that Beto O'Rourke came as close as he did in Texas, I think, is really telling. Andrew Gillum is very progressive for the state of Florida, and yet here we are in this massive recount battle. So it's an interesting kind of window into the future of the electoral process to consider whether or not there are, you know, there are some Democrats who could break through some of these reliable Republican states.
Dennis, what are you watching 1 week after the 2018 midterms?
Well, I've always maintained that elections work anywhere in the world. They work only if the loser agrees to lose. Otherwise, the alternative is basically you take to the hills and arm yourselves. And we see that in countries all over the world. My concern here is that at broader level of process, and we saw this with President Trump suggesting during the campaign in 2016 that if he didn't win, the election was rigged. That's playing with fire, nuclear level fire, so to speak. And it's become an article of faith among many Republicans that Democrats cannot win an honest election. So that means if the Democrats appear to have won, the election must not have been honest. In other words, the Republicans maintain that, no, we're not going to agree to lose because it was not honest. So all sorts of charges are made by Governor Scott in Florida, by the president, among others, that, you know, there's voter fraud and those sorts of things with no shred of evidence whatsoever.
No evidence.
No. And so I'm very concerned about the integrity of our electoral system. And this is consistent with the general attack on our institutions, which are not flawless, but still, generally speaking, they work well. There are always accidents, but it's an attempt to achieve power at the cost of undermining the legitimacy of our institutions and processes. Mm-hmm. That's very troubling.
Mm-hmm. And I would note that I think Arizona is actually an interesting antidote to this. Very close election. You know, you went into this recount period, this kind of prolonged consideration of who would actually win, and then a very civil resolution to that process.
A very gracious sort of concession speech or
viral
video, actually.
Yeah, there's some word now that the governor may actually appoint McSally to fill vacancy.
McCain's seat, right.
Yeah, exactly, which would potentially be a really interesting, an interesting result.
Years ago, Barry Goldwater once said, you know, a good Arizona Western cowboy conservative, he said that somebody ought to saw off the eastern seaboard and let it float out into the Atlantic back to Europe. I think I'm increasingly thinking, I wish somebody would saw off Florida and let it float off somewhere, because this will be at least the second time they fouled up our electoral
process.
Why
not? I think it would be probably less work to get them voting machines that work accurately.
Yes, and much less work.
And design foolproof ballots.
There you go. Yeah, we've had too much of this out of Florida. And as you mentioned, some of the reports of this fraud, which without evidence seem sort of strikingly similar to what we had in the 2000 presidential election with Florida. Deja vu.
As was the case then, many of these electoral officials charged with supervising the electoral process are themselves Republican appointees. Mm-hmm. So, again, there are all these charges, but they're made basically to set fires so that we can distract from what's actually going on the ground.
Dennis Goldford is with us of Drake University, Rachel Caulfield, his colleague also of Drake, our political scientists on this edition of Politics Wednesday, River to River. We'll be back in just a moment to talk to Rachel and Dennis about Nancy Pelosi. How much of a struggle is she going to have to become Speaker again? And what will the Democrats have as priorities when they control the House? What do you think should be the priorities of the incoming Democrats, including two Democratic Congresswomen from Iowa? I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us, our political scientists for this week, and cutting through a lot of material here, getting analysis on the Whitaker controversy, the acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, also the aftermath of the 2018 elections just a week ago, and some of those seats in the House and also in the Senate, still not settled. So we don't have the final tally here. Rachel, does this tally with what you have? It looks like in the House, the Democrats picking up in the end somewhere between 35 and 40 seats, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Dennis, in the Senate, be a 1, 2, or 3 seat difference?
Right. The Democrats gained a seat in Arizona that belonged to the late senator. That's Jeff being Blake held right seat, now, yeah. Right? Jeff Flake's seat. John Kyle is occupying the McCain seat right now. But they, the Democrats picked up one of those two Republican seats, so that's a gain, but they lost Missouri, North Dakota, and Indiana. And then the question, of course, is, and they held on to Virginia, so the question is Florida, certainly. Mm-hmm. So there may be a Republican gain of two or three, something like that. It's just mm-hmm. a little more of a cushion for Mitch McConnell.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Want to talk this half hour a little bit about the priorities of the new Democratic Congress, as far as we can tell from this vantage point, a couple months away from that Congress being seated. 1-866-780-9100. Jeff is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Am I on?
You sure are, sir. Hello? Welcome to the program.
I am. Say, sometimes, you know, it's possible for commentators to avoid the obvious. And the obvious from the Senate races is that if you want to lose and have a moderate centrist Democrat as your nominee, Heidkamp Camp was a moderate centrist Democrat. She lost. McCaskill lost. Nelson is going to lose. Donnelly lost. And that's opening the door for the Republicans to pack the federal judiciary with any number of Brett Kavanaughs. Also in Iowa, Democrats nominated a moderate centrist candidate for governor. He lost disastrously for the Democratic Party. And he ran behind Abby Finkenauer, who's a progressive Democrat, in every single county where she ran. I mean, she supported expanding Medicare. She supported the minimum wage. She supported unions. None of these issues did talk about.
Yeah, so, Jeff, what I'm hearing from you,
the lesson of the election.
The lesson of the elections is Democrats should go progressive, not moderate. I guess I'm hearing that. Okay.
Well, that's the evidence.
Okay, you've tallied it pretty well there, Jeff in Iowa City. Dennis, Rachel, what do you think of Jeff's ideas there?
There's an argument that occurs in political parties everywhere. I've seen the same argument in German politics when I was there. It's what we can call the realists versus the purists. And the purists, and they're mirror images on the Republican and Democratic sides here. And the assumption is, say, if you're a conservative Republican, there is a massive conservative majority out there in the country that never shows up because you don't nominate pure conservative candidates. If you do so, they'll show up. You'll win the election. Well, what we just heard was the Democratic version of that. There's a massive liberal majority out there in the country. They don't show up because you don't nominate sufficiently pure liberal or conservative or progressive candidates. So it's the same kind of argument. And then the realists say, look, there isn't this massive majority one way or the other out there. So what we've got to do is find somebody who can appeal as much as possible to people on both sides of that gap within each party.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, to Dennis's point, Heidkamp, McCaskill, these are moderate Democrats in predominantly red states. So it's not a surprise that a Democrat would lose. You know, they won by being moderate in those states. And then ultimately in the era of Trump, as the Republican Party has changed, and the Democratic Party has changed for that matter, they were not able to maintain those seats in this midterm election cycle. Again, I would nod to Kyrsten Sinema as the exception to that rule, where a moderate Democrat did win a Senate race in what has always been thought of as a very red state. You know, I think one of the things that the argument of our caller may be pointing out, however, is that, you know, there does seem to be some overlap in the concerns of the so-called populists on the right and the so-called populists on the left. This idea of economic empowerment and really speaking to the working class voter and the idea that Democrats could craft messages that better attract those voters to their candidates. So that's one of the things that I think, you know, as we talk about the potential of realignment, and particularly realignment going on across those red states, I think a lot of Democrats are looking to those issues and saying, look, we can do a much better job of speaking to these issues.
This goes to the earlier point Rachel made about the quality of the candidates ran this time. First and foremost, you've got to know where you're running for office, because there's sufficient difference among the various cultures in the various states that, you know, a Mississippi Democrat may well have much more in common with a Mississippi Republican than she will with a Massachusetts Democrat.
Right.
So you've got to match the candidate to the state and not just run this generic candidate, because we're so diverse across our in the cultures in our country, in the various states and areas of the country, that just doesn't work. And, yeah, somebody for this candidate may not be sufficiently liberal or progressive as a Democrat, but that particular person in a Senate could go well, go a step toward making the majority leader in the Senate, who runs the Senate, a Democrat. And it's the same on the House side. You may not be sufficiently liberal, but you're going to make Nancy Pelosi or somebody like that Speaker of the House. And that counts for something, because you control the committees. You can decide how to use investigatory powers. So this is institutionally important.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield, our analysts this week on Politics Wednesday, River to River. Let's talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi. You mentioned her. House Democrats arriving in Washington for orientation this week. So I assume that means Abby Finkenauer, Cindy Axne, our two newest members of Congress, unseating two males in the first and third districts here in Iowa. So three of four of our districts now will be headed by Democrats after the lame duck session.
And 50% women.
And 50% women. You're right. Six, six, three and three.
That's right.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi. That was a big campaign issue that the Republicans used, endlessly demonizing Pelosi, connecting her to anybody who was running for Congress, Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer. Now there's a question here, reports saying that Democratic representatives contending that their private conversations reveal that Pelosi will soon learn that she lacks backing within the full House to be elected Speaker next year, despite her confidence that she would lock down the necessary support. So yesterday, in a one-on-one with a CNN moderator, Nancy Pelosi states that she's 100% confident she will be the Speaker of the House.
Now, you said there, in the context of your answer, I'll be the Speaker,
yeah,
I'll be the people's Speaker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What is your level of confidence that you'll be the Speaker of the House?
Total.
100%.
100%, yeah. I sent out my letter last night because I didn't ask anybody for support because I was too busy winning an election, and I didn't think it was appropriate to ask members or candidates then. And how it works is the caucus nominates someone,
yes,
and then they go to the floor. And
do you
the
think there'll
goes.
Be another nominee other than you?
Doesn't matter. I've had a nominee every time.
Okay. Confidence. You can hear it in her voice. Rachel, do you think she has it locked down?
Well, you know, I have a hard time envisioning a world where she doesn't, if she wants to be Speaker, where she doesn't win the speakership. Having said that, there are, of course, Democrats in the House right now who for a long time have said, look, you know, the party needs new institutional leadership, fresh voices, fresh ideas, renewed energy, a different public presence. And so they say that they are 100% confident that they can deny her the speakership.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a potential here that we have a real fight among the Democrats. And, you know, it seems, given Donald Trump's tweet about this last week, it seems that the president is kind of cheering for a fight on this front.
Mm-hmm. Even more to the point, beyond mm-hmm. that general sense of needing new leadership, there are specific candidates who ran on the Democratic side promising
absolutely
they would not vote for her for Speaker. So they're in a rock between a rock and a hard place if this comes up, because believe me, if they do not keep that first promise, next time they have to run for election, there will be ads from Republicans and independent groups supporting Republicans about how this person wasn't even in Congress yet and yet broke that first promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if we remember the last ditch effort by J.D. Chilton to beat Steve King included an ad that said, I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi. Now, Republicans, as I said, endlessly demonized her in the campaign, used her, connected her with you know, congressional candidates, including Cindy Axne and Abby Finkenauer. I don't know if you had on your screens when I was pop up something, all the political ads that had these green hues of Nancy Pelosi's face, and then it would morph into either an Abby Finkenauer or Cindy Axne. Does that mean Pelosi is truly a liability for Dems, or is that a signal that Republicans fear her as House Speaker because she is savvy and effective?
Well, I think different people would probably answer this differently. From an institutional standpoint, I would just say the Speaker of the House, this is a partisan bulldog position. That's what the Speaker of the House is supposed to be. The House is a very partisan institution. The majority party rules the roost when it comes to the House of Representatives. They have an amazing amount of authority. And so the Speaker of the House is oftentimes demonized by the opposition as kind of a symbol of this overt, very strong partisanship that Americans distrust and don't like. But it makes the House run, and we oftentimes don't understand the importance of that role in the House.
Mm-hmm. Now, this new House, which the Democrats are majority in, is the most diverse in history, I think, gender-wise and also ethnically, perhaps ideologically. Dennis, can they build a unified legislative agenda despite these differences?
That's the $64,000 question. We don't know because, you know, unlike a parliamentary system whereby if members of the party don't stick together, the ones that have constituted the government, the administration in American terms, the government falls and they have to have new elections. So they have something at stake. But, you know, with our system, to a great extent, on any piece of legislation, you've got to build a coalition each time. You start off with a good number of people in your party, but you've got to construct almost a new coalition or at least a slightly different coalition at the very least for any piece of legislation. But you have to remember now we have divided government. So the Senate's perfectly capable of saying, no, thank you, to whatever might come out of the House. Or even if something came out of both the House and the Senate, the president is very capable of saying, no, thank you. So, you know, we may be in a period of gridlock. I don't know. The president had talked about an interest in infrastructure. He talked about that with Chuck Schumer in the Senate and Nancy Pelosi in the House at the beginning of his term, but that went away in a hurry. So the question is, what kind of record will the president want to build, if it is a real record rather than symbolic record, the wall and so forth? Or would Democrats even want to give anything to the president that he could claim as a success to run on in 2020?
Let's talk a little bit about the 4th District, retained by Congressman Steve King, I believe, for his ninth election or reelection. Yesterday in Ottumwa, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, who, of course, won her election, was asked by reporters if she's spoken with Steve King about the series of controversy he's been facing lately with regards to far-right European politicians and his racist commentary. She answered with what many are classifying as an ultimatum. Let's listen to it.
I think that Steve King needs to make a decision if he wants to represent the people and the values of the 4th District or do something else.
How do you interpret that, Rachel?
Well, you know, there has been growing condemnation of a continued string of comments by Steve King. And, the governor during the election cycle, I think, had a real hard time distancing herself from Steve King. Steve King has a very fervent base of support within the 4th District. And so I think she felt like she really needed that coalition of voters. Post-election, she's much more free to distance herself now.
Right, right. As the race wound down between her and Fred Hubble, Hubble repeatedly called on her to remove King as, what, campaign co-chair?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so timing here is everything. That
this,
after rather than before the election, right, Dennis?
Right.
This will not go down as a profile in courage for Kim Reynolds. She could have said something when it mattered, when it meant something, but she chose not to. She just kept her arms around him until she got what she needed out of the 4th District in terms of votes. And now, as Rachel politely put it, she may have more freedom to distance herself. But it would have meant more if she had done the courageous thing, if she believes he is truly morally wrong in what he says, if she had taken that stance before Election Day.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in the news something happening on the Drake campus related to this. Is it true that on your Drake campus there in Des Moines, shutting down, over this time, from noon to 1 p.m. for a rally in response to hate crimes, that there have also been robocalls made to students and faculty from a white supremacy group. Have you heard about this, either of you?
Oh, we've heard about it, yes.
We've heard about it. Yes, there have been two messages conveyed to students of color on campus. And then while a meeting was going on to address the first of those incidents, there were robocalls that went out to about 250 phone lines, hard phone lines across the campus. And those were sponsored by a white supremacist group out of Idaho. And so today from 12 to 1, our students are gathering in Helmet Commons to express solidarity with our students of color and convey a very clear message that we don't find this acceptable as a campus community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to our phones. Karen is joining us from Waterloo. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just had a couple of thoughts on this issue.
Quickly, if you could. We're coming at the end of the hour. Thanks.
Okay, here's the deal. I don't like Steve King at all, but I don't think that the governor can come out at this point in time and say, hey, make your mind up, Steve. Do you want to represent Iowa or not? What he has to do is represent his constituents, and they have again voted for him. So he clearly does. If you say, if we don't like what you're saying now, Steve, we're going to get rid of you, ultimatum or not, then she can issue the same sort of ultimatum to any Democrat or independent who is also an elected official, and it's a pretty slippery slope then, is it not?
Mm. Karen, thanks for the comment from Waterloo. Comment on Karen.
I would say that if you believe that what Steve King says is wrong, it's not acceptable, you know, that's fair enough to a position to take if that's what you want. But remember, Steve King doesn't elect himself. And so if you don't like, and you may support what Steve King says, but if you oppose what Steve King says, your real argument is not with Steve King directly. It's with the people of the 4th District who continue to vote for him to say those things in Congress.
Perhaps a quick word before we go about the media battle between the presidents and the news media. I'm reading The Hill right now. Fox News joining a number of media outlets today announcing they would back CNN's, this is Fox News, backing CNN's lawsuit against the Trump administration. CNN filing a lawsuit against the White House yesterday, seeking the return of correspondent Jim Acosta's press credentials, revoked last week after that, you remember that testy exchange, grab the microphone thing with President Trump during the press conference. Perhaps we can conclude here with a little bit of the latest chapter. It's a long book, you know, with several chapters, the Trump versus the news media book, I guess.
And it's still being written every day.
It's still being written. Rachel, what are your thoughts here?
Well,
we've got news outlets opposing, news outlets joining forces saying you can't do that. You can't pick who's going to cover you.
Yeah, and that's a pretty powerful statement. There's a strong norm here that the president, of course, is meant to face tough questions when they do a press conference. That's the entire purpose, is that the media comes in and asks hard questions and presses the president for details on policy, on events that are happening in the world. To remove Jim Acosta for the questioning that went on last week, by virtually any metric that you might use to evaluate the president's relationship with the press, that is just simply so far outside the boundaries of what is considered to be normal and acceptable in that relationship, that it's not terribly surprising that we see a lot of news media binding together now and supporting CNN in this lawsuit.
Dennis, your thoughts?
The president plays to his base. I mean, some wit said the president or Mr. Trump is not governed as president of the United States, he's governed as president of his base. And the base loves this narrative of the president fighting off these evil journalists who distort what he says and say untrue things about him. That's the argument. But we have to remember that in a parliamentary system, the opposition party can question the governing party directly in parliament.
Mm-hmm.
We have no way of doing that in our system. Congress can't question the president in the well of the House directly. The closest thing we have is a press conference when reporters question the president directly. And that's a very necessary function. It was considered so necessary. It was part of the First Amendment.
I think that's it for this hour. We've run out of time. Thank you very much. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Drake University. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science also at Drake. We enjoy your commentary, your analysis, and appreciate the fact that you've stepped into our studio, Dennis and Rachel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the program, you want to listen to this. There's a new biography, perhaps you've heard, of Winston Churchill. And this has... The biographer has had access to a lot of documents that were not accessed by previous biographers. I'll talk with him tomorrow on this program and ask what Churchill might tell us about the challenges facing leaders today. Tomorrow on the program, Winston Churchill in the spotlight. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help from Alyssa Bovinette, John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.